Chapter 33. Israeli Embassy, Rome. Gabriel dropped Donate at the Jesuit Curia, then headed to the Israeli Embassy. Downstairs, he locked the first page of the Gospel of Pilate in an office safe and rang Yuval Gershon of Unit 8200 on a secure phone in the Holy of Holies. It was past midnight in Tel Aviv. Gershon was in bed. "What now?" he asked wearily. "A German conglomerate called the Wolf Group." "Anyone specific?"
"Herr Wolf."
"How deep?" "Proctological." Gershon exhaled into the mouthpiece of his phone. "And I thought it was going to be something unreasonable." "I'll get to the unreasonable request in a minute. Are you looking for something in particular?" Gabriel recited several keywords and names. One of the names was his own. Another was the name of the Roman military officer who had served as the prefect of Judea from approximately 26 CE to December of 36. "The Pontius Pilate?" said Gershon. "How many Pontius Pilates do you know, Yuval?" "I assume this has something to do with our visit to the secret archives." Gabriel indicated it did. He also insinuated that while inside the archives he'd been given the first page of a rather interesting document. "By whom?" "A priest named Father Joshua." "That's strange."
"Why?"
"Because you and Archbishop Donati were the only ones in the manuscript depository."
"We spoke to him."
"If you say so. What else?"
"The Institute for Works of Religion, better known as the Vatican Bank. I just emailed you a list of names. I want to know whether any of them received large payments lately."
"Define large."
"Six figures or more."
"How many names are we talking about?"
116.
Gershon swore softly. "Are you forgetting that I have pictures of you dressed as a priest?"
"I'll make it up to you, Yuval."
"Who are these guys?"
"The cardinals who will elect the next pope."
Gabriel killed the connection and dialed Yossi Gavish, the chief of the office's analytical division. Born in Golders Green, educated at Oxford, he still spoke Hebrew with a pronounced British accent. "Father Gabriel, I presume?"
"Check your inbox, my son."
A moment passed. "It's lovely, boss, but who is he?"
"He's a lay member of something called the Order of St. Helena, but I have a feeling he might be one of us. Show it around the building and send it to Berlin Station."
"Why Berlin?"
"He speaks German with a Bavarian accent."
"I was afraid you were going to say that."
Gabriel hung up the phone and placed one more call. Chiara answered, her voice heavy with sleep.
"Where are you?"
she asked. "Somewhere safe."
"When are you coming home?"
"Soon."
"What does that mean?"
"It means I have to find something first."
"Is it good?"
"Do you remember when Ailey and I found the ruins of Solomon's temple?"
"How could I forget?"
"This might be better."
"Is there anything I can do to help?"
"Close your eyes," said Gabriel. "Let me listen to you sleep."
Gabriel spent the night on a cot inside the station, and at 7:30 the next morning rang General Cesare Ferrari. He informed the general that he needed to borrow the art squad's formidable laboratory to test a document. He did not say what the document was or where he had found it.
"Why do you need our labs? Yours are the best in the world."
"I don't have time to send it to Israel."
"What sort of tests are we talking about?"
"Analysis of the paper and ink. I'd also like you to establish the age."
"It's old, this document?"
"Several centuries," said Gabriel.
"You're sure it's paper and not vellum?"
"So I've been told."
"I have a staff meeting at the Palazzo at 10:30.
The Palazzo was the art squad's elegant cream-colored headquarters in the Piazza di Sant'Ignazio. "If, however, you were to wander into the back room of Café Greco at 9:15, you might find me enjoying a cappuccino and a cornetto. And by the way," he said before ringing off, "I have something to show you as well."
Gabriel arrived a few minutes early. General Ferrari had the back room to himself. From his old leather briefcase he removed a manila folder, and from the folder 8 large photographs, which he arrayed on the table. The last depicted Gabriel removing the wallet from Niklos Jansson's pocket. "Since when does the commander of the art squad get to see surveillance photos from a murder investigation?"
"The chief of the Polizia wanted you to have a look at them. He was hoping you might be able to identify the assassin."
The general laid another photograph on the table. A man in a motorcycle helmet and leather jacket, right arm extended, a gun in his hand. A woman nearby had noticed the weapon and had opened her mouth to scream. Gabriel only wished he had seen it too. Niklaus Jansson might still be alive. Gabriel examined the gunman's clothing.
I don't suppose you have one without the helmet.
I'm afraid not.
Ferrari returned the photographs to the manila folder.
Perhaps you should show me this document of yours.
It was locked inside a stainless steel attaché case. Gabriel removed it and handed it wordlessly across the table. The general scrutinized it through the protective plaster cover.
The Gospel of Pilate?
He looked up at Gabriel.
Where did you get this?
The Vatican Secret Archives.
They gave it to you?
Not exactly.
What does that mean?
It means Luigi and I broke into the archives and took it. General Ferrari looked down at the document again.
I assume this has something to do with the Holy Father's death.
Murder, said Gabriel quietly. General Ferrari's expression remained unchanged. You don't seem terribly surprised by the news, Cesare. I assumed that Archbishop Donati was suspicious about the circumstances of the Holy Father's death when he asked me to make contact with you in Venice. Did he mention a missing Swiss guard?
He might have.
And a missing letter, too. The general held the page aloft.
Is this the document Lucchese wanted you to see?
Gabriel nodded.
In that case, there's no need to test it. The Holy Father wouldn't have tried to give it to you if it wasn't genuine.
I'd feel better if I knew when it was written and where the paper and ink came from. The general raised it to the light of an overhead chandelier.
You're right. It's definitely paper.
How old could it be?
The first mills in Italy were established in Fabriano in the late 13th century, and during the 15th century, paper gradually replaced vellum in bookbinding. There were mills in Florence, Treviso, Milan, Bologna, Parma, and your beloved Venice. We should be able to determine if this was produced in one of them, but it's not something that can be done quickly.
How long will it take?
To do the job right? Several weeks?
I'm going to need the results a bit sooner than that. The general sighed. If it wasn't for you, said Gabriel, I'd still be in Venice with my family.
Me?
The general shook his head.
I was only the messenger. It was Pietro Lucchese who summoned you.
He glanced at the manila folder. Those photos are yours to keep. A small souvenir of your brief visit to our country. Don't worry about the polizia. I'll think of something to say to them, I always do. With that, the general departed. Gabriel checked his phone and saw that he had received a text message from Christoph Bittel, his friend from the Swiss Security Service. Call me as quickly as you can, it's important. Gabriel dialed. Bittel answered instantly.
For God's sake, what the hell took you so long?
Please tell me she's all right.
Stephanie Hoffmann? She's fine. I'm calling about the man in that sketch of yours.
What about him?
It's not something we should discuss on the phone. How quickly can you get to Zurich?
Chapter 34 Sistine Chapel. From inside the Sistine Chapel came the unholy clamor of hammering. Cardinal Domenico Albanese climbed the two shallow steps and entered. A newly installed wooden ramp sloped toward the opening in the transenna, the marble screen that divided the chapel in two. Beyond it stretched a temporary wooden floor covered in pale tan carpeting. 12 long tables stood along the edges of the chapel, two rows of three on each side, covered in tan baize with pleated skirts of magenta. In the center of the space stood a small ornate table with thin curved legs. For now the table was empty. But on Friday afternoon, when the cardinal electors processed into the chapel to begin the conclave, there would be a Bible open to the first page of the Gospel of Matthew. Each cardinal, including Albanese, would lay his hand on the Gospel and swear an oath of secrecy. He would also swear not to conspire with any group of people or individuals who might wish to intervene in the election of the next Roman pontiff. To break such a sacred vow would be a grievous sin. A cardinal sin, thought Albanese.
The sound of hammering intruded on his reverie. The workmen were constructing a camera platform near the stoves. The first hour of the conclave, the opening procession, the singing of Veni Creator Spiritus, the swearing of the oath, would be televised. After that, the master of pontifical liturgical celebrations would announce Extra Omnes, and the doors would be closed and locked from the outside. Inside, a first ballot would be taken, if only to get a sense of the room. The scrutineers and revisers would perform their due diligence, checking and rechecking the count. If the pre-conclave hype was to be believed, Cardinal Jose Maria Navarro would emerge as the early frontrunner. The ballots would then be burned in the older of the two stoves. The second stove would simultaneously release a chemically enhanced plume of black smoke, and thus the faithful gathered in St. Peter's Square and the unfaithful poised over their laptops in the press center would learn that the Church of Rome was still without a pontiff. Cardinal Navarro's lead would shrink on the second ballot, and on the third, a new name would emerge, Cardinal Franz von Emmerich, the Archbishop of Vienna, and a secret member of the Order of St. Helena. By the fifth ballot, Emmerich would be unstoppable. By the sixth, the papacy would be his. No, thought Albanese suddenly. The papacy would be the Order's. They planned to waste little time in undoing the modest reforms put in place by Lucchese and Donati. All power would be centralized in the Apostolic Palace. All dissent would be ruthlessly repressed. There would be no more talk of women in the priesthood or allowing priests to marry, nor would there be any heartfelt encyclicals about climate change, the poor, the rights of workers and immigrants, and the dangers posed by the rise of the far right in Western Europe. Indeed, the new Secretary of State would forge close ties between the Holy See and the authoritarian leaders of Italy, Germany, Austria, and France, all doctrinaire Catholics who would serve as a bulwark against secularism, democratic socialism, and of course, Islam. Albanese moved toward the altar. Behind it was Michelangelo's Last Judgment, with its swirling cyclone of souls rising toward heaven or falling into the depths of hell. It never failed to stir Albanese. It was the reason he had become a priest, the fear that he would suffer for all eternity in the emptiness of the underworld. That fear, after lying dormant within Albanese for many years, had risen again. It was true that Bishop Richter had granted him absolution for his role in the murder of Pietro Lucchese. But in his heart, Albanese did not believe such a mortal sin could truly be forgiven. Granted, it was Father Graff who had done the deed, but Albanese had been an accessory before and after the fact. He had played his role flawlessly, with one exception. He had failed to find the letter. The letter Lucchese was writing to Gabriel Allon about the book he had found in the secret archives. The only explanation was that the Jansson boy had taken it. Father Graff had killed him as well. Two murders, two black marks on Albanese's soul. All the more reason why the conclave had to go precisely as planned. It was Albanese's job to make certain the cardinal electors who had accepted the order's money cast their ballots for Emmerich at the appropriate time. A sudden and decisive move toward the Austrian would raise suspicion of tampering. His support had to build gradually, ballot by ballot, so that nothing looked amiss. Once Emmerich was clad in white, the order would face no threat of exposure. The Vatican was one of the world's last absolute monarchies, a divine dictatorship. There would be no investigation, no exhumation of the dead pontiff's body. It would almost be as though it had never happened. Unless, thought Albanese, there was another unexpected development like the one that had occurred the previous morning at the secret archives. Gabriel Allon and Archbishop Donati had undoubtedly found something. What it was, Albanese could not say. He only knew that after leaving the archives, Allon and Donati had traveled to Assisi, where they had met with a certain Father Robert Jordan, the Church's foremost expert on the apocryphal Gospels. Afterward, they had returned to Rome, where they had met with one Alessandro Ricci, the world's foremost expert on the Order of St. Helena. It was hardly an encouraging sign. Truly magnificent, is it not? Albanese turned with a start. Forgive me, said Bishop Richter. I didn't mean to disturb you. Albanese addressed his superior general with a cool and distant formality.
Good morning, Excellency. What brings you to the Sistina?
I was told I might find the Camerlengo here.
Is there a problem?
Not at all. In fact, I have rather good news.
What's that?
Richter smiled. Gabriel alone just left Rome. Chapter 35. Zurich. It was 4:30 when Gabriel arrived in Zurich. He rode in a taxi to the Paradeplatz, the St. Peter's Square of Swiss banking, and then walked along the stately Bahnhofstrasse to the northern tip of the Zürichsee. A BMW sedan drew alongside him and the General Guisson Quay. Behind the wheel was Christoph Bittel. Bald and bespectacled, he looked like just another gnome heading home to the lakeside suburbs after a long day spent tabulating the hidden riches of Arab sheikhs and Russian oligarchs. Gabriel dropped into the passenger seat.
Where were we?
The man in the sketch, Bittel eased into the rush hour traffic. I'm sorry it took me so long to make the connection. It's been a few years since I've seen him.
What's his name?
Estermann, said Bittel. Andreas Estermann.
As Gabriel suspected, Estermann was a professional. For 30 years he had worked for the BFV, Germany's Internal Security Service. Not surprisingly, the BFV maintained close links with its sister service in Switzerland, the NDB. Early in his career, Bittel had traveled to Cologne to brief his German counterparts on Soviet espionage activity in Bern and Geneva. Estermann was his contact. When the meeting was over, he invited me for a drink, which was odd.
Why?
Estermann doesn't touch alcohol.
Does he have a problem?
He has lots of problems, but alcohol isn't one of them.
In the years that followed their first meeting, Bittel and Estermann bumped into each other from time to time, as practitioners of the secret trade are prone to do. Neither one of them was what you might describe as an action figure. They were not operatives, they were glorified policemen. They conducted investigations, wrote reports, and attended countless conferences where the primary challenge was keeping one's eyes open. They shared lunches and dinners whenever their paths crossed. Estermann often funneled intelligence to Bittel outside normal channels. Bittel reciprocated whenever possible, but always with the approval of the top floor. His superiors considered Estermann a valuable asset. And then the planes crashed into the World Trade Center and everything changed, especially Estermann.
How so?
He had moved from counterintelligence to counterterrorism a couple of years before 9/11, just like me. He claimed he was on to the Hamburg cell from the beginning. He swore he could have stopped the plot in its tracks if his superiors had allowed him to do his job properly.
Was any of it true?
That he could have single-handedly prevented the worst terrorist attack in history? Bittel shook his head. Maybe Gabriel Allon could have done it, but not Andreas Estermann.
How did he change?
He became incredibly bitter.
At whom?
Muslims. Al-Qaeda? Not just Al-Qaeda. Estermann resented all Muslims, especially those who lived in Germany. He was unable to separate the hardcore jihadist from the poor Moroccan or Turk who came to Europe looking for a better life. It got worse after the attack on the Vatican. He lost all perspective. I found his company difficult to bear.
But you maintained the relationship?
We're a small service. Estermann was a force multiplier, Bittel smiled. Like you, Alon.
He turned into the car park of a marina along the western shore of the lake. At the end of the breakwater was a cafe. They sat outside in the blustery evening air. Bittel ordered 2 beers and replied to several text messages he had received during the drive from downtown Zurich.
Sorry, we're a bit on edge at the moment.
About what?
The bombings in Germany.
Bittel peered at Gabriel over his phone.
You don't happen to know who's behind them, do you?
My analysts think we're dealing with a new network.
Just what we needed.
The waitress appeared with their drinks. She was a raven-haired woman of perhaps 25, very beautiful, and Iraqi, perhaps a refugee from Syria. When she placed a bottle of beer in front of Gabriel, he thanked her in Arabic. A brief exchange of pleasantries followed, then
Smiling, the woman withdrew.
"What were you talking about?" asked Bittell.
"She was wondering why we were sitting out here by the lake instead of inside where it's warm."
"What did you tell her?"
"That we were intelligence officers who didn't like to speak in insecure rooms."
Bittell made a face and drank some of his beer.
"It's a good thing Esterman didn't see you talking to her like that. He doesn't approve of being civil to Muslim immigrants. Nor does he approve of speaking their language."
"How does he feel about Jews?"
Bittell picked at the label of his beer bottle.
"Go ahead, Bittell. It won't hurt my feelings."
"He's a bit of an anti-Semite."
"What a shocker."
"It tends to go hand in hand."
"What's that?"
"Islamophobia and anti-Semitism."
"Did you and Esterman ever discuss religion?"
"Endlessly, especially after the attack on the Vatican. He's a devout Catholic."
"And you?"
"I'm from Nidwalden. I was raised in a Catholic home. I married a Catholic girl in a ceremony officiated by the church, and all three of our children were baptized."
"But?"
"I haven't been to Mass since the sexual abuse scandal broke."
"Do you follow the teachings of the Vatican? Or should I follow them if they don't?"
"I assume Esterman disagreed with you."
Bittell nodded.
"He's a lay member of an extremely conservative order based here in Switzerland."
"The Order of St. Helena."
Bittell's eyes narrowed. "How did you know?"
Gabriel demurred.
"I assume Esterman wanted you to join. He was like an evangelist. He said I could be a secret member that no one would know other than his bishop. He also said there were lots of people like us in the order."
"Us?"
"Intelligence officers and security types. Prominent businessmen and politicians, too. He said joining the order would do wonders for my post-NDB career."
"How did you handle it?"
"I told him I wasn't interested and changed the subject."
"When was the last time you spoke to him?"
"It's been 5 years, at least. Probably more like 6.
"What was the occasion?"
"Esterman's retirement from the BFV. He wanted to give me his new contact information. Apparently, he struck gold. He's working for a big German firm based in Munich."
"The Wolf Group?"
"How did—"
"Lucky guess," said Gabriel.
"Esterman told me to call him when I was ready to leave the NDB. There's a Wolf Group office here in Zurich. He said he would make it worth my while."
"You don't happen to have his cell number, do you?"
"Sure. Why?"
"I'd like you to take him up on his offer. Tell him you're going to be in Munich on Wednesday evening. Tell him you want to talk about your future."
"But I can't possibly go to Munich on Wednesday."
"He doesn't need to know that."
"What do you have in mind?"
"Drinks. Somewhere quiet."
"I told you he doesn't drink. He's a diet cook, man. Always a diet cook."
Bittell tapped the tabletop thoughtfully.
"There's a place in the Beethovenplatz called Café Adagio. Very chic. Discreet, too. The question is, what's going to happen when he gets there?"
"I'm going to ask him a few questions."
"About what?"
"The Order of St. Helena."
"Why are you interested in the Order?"
"They murdered a friend of mine."
"Who's the friend?"
"His Holiness Pope Paul VII.
Bittell's expression betrayed no sentiment, least of all surprise.
"Now I know why you wanted me to keep an eye on the Hoffman woman."
"Send the message, Bittell."
His thumbs hovered over his phone.
"Do you know what will happen if I'm linked to this in any way?
The office will lose a valuable partner, and I'll lose a friend."
"I'm not sure I want to be your friend, Alon. They all seem to end up dead."
Bittell typed the message and tapped send. 5 long minutes elapsed before his phone pinged with a response.
"You're on. 6 o'clock Wednesday evening at the Café Adagio. Esterman's looking forward to it."
Gabriel gazed at the black waters of the lake.
"That makes 2 of us."
Chapter 36. Munich. Except for a few days in September 1972, Munich had never mattered much to the office. Nevertheless, if only for sentimental reasons, housekeeping maintained a large walled villa in the Bohemian quarter of Schwabing, not far from the Englischer Garten. Elie Lavon arrived there at 10:15 the following morning. Gloomily, he surveyed the heavy antique furnishings in the formal drawing room.
I can't believe we're back here again. He looked at Gabriel and frowned. You're supposed to be on holiday.
Yes, I know.
What happened?
A death in the family.
My condolences.
Lavon tossed his overnight bag carelessly onto a couch. He had wispy, unkempt hair and a bland, forgettable face that even the most gifted portrait artist would have struggled to capture in oil on canvas. He appeared to be one of life's downtrodden. In truth, he was a natural predator who could follow a highly trained intelligence officer or hardened terrorist down any street in the world without attracting a flicker of interest. He was now the chief of the office division known as Neviot. Its operatives included surveillance artists, pickpockets, thieves, and those who specialized in planting hidden cameras and listening devices behind locked doors.
I saw an interesting photo of you the other day. You were dressed as a priest and walking into the Vatican secret archives with your friend, Luigi Donati.
I was only sorry I couldn't join you.
Lavon smiled.
Find anything interesting?
You might say that. Lavon raised a tiny hand.
Do tell.
We should probably wait until the others arrive.
They're on their way, all of them.
Lavon's lighter flared.
I assume this has something to do with the unfortunate passing of His Holiness Pope Paul VII.
Gabriel nodded.
I take it His Holiness did not die of natural causes.
No, said Gabriel, he did not.
Do we have a suspect?
A Catholic order based in Canton Zug. Lavon stared at Gabriel through a cloud of smoke.
The Order of St. Helena?
You've heard of them?
Unfortunately, I dealt with the order in a previous life.
During a lengthy hiatus from the office, Lavon had run a small investigative agency in Vienna called Wartime Claims and Inquiries. Operating on a shoestring budget, he had tracked down millions of dollars worth of looted Holocaust assets. He left Vienna after a bomb destroyed his office and killed two of his employees, both young women. The perpetrator, a former SS officer named Erik Radek, had died in an Israeli prison cell. Gabriel was the one who put him there.
It was a case involving a Viennese family named Feldman, explained Lavon. The patriarch was Samuel Feldman, a well-to-do exporter of high-quality textiles. In the autumn of 1937, as storm clouds were gathering over Austria, two priests from the order came calling on Feldman at his apartment in the First District. One of the priests was the order's founder, Father Ulrich Schiller.
And what did Father Schiller want from Samuel Feldman?
Money. What else?
What was he offering in return?
Baptismal certificates. Feldman was desperate, so he gave Father Schiller a substantial sum of cash and other valuables, including several paintings.
And when the Nazis rolled into Vienna in March 1938?
Father Schiller and the promised baptismal certificates were nowhere to be found. Feldman and most of his family were deported to the Lublin district of Poland, where they were murdered by Einsatzgruppen. One child survived the war in hiding in Vienna, a daughter named Isabel. She came to me after the Swiss banking scandal broke and told me the story.
What did you do?
I made an appointment to see Bishop Hans Richter, the Superior General of the Order of St. Helena. We met at its medieval priory in Menzingen. A nasty piece of work, the bishop. There were moments when I had to remind myself that I was actually speaking to a Roman Catholic cleric. Needless to say, I left empty-handed.
Did you let it drop?
Me? Of course not. And within a year I found four other cases of the order soliciting donations from Jews in exchange for promises of protection. Bishop Richter wouldn't see me again, so I turned over my material to an Italian investigative reporter named Alessandro Ricci. He found a few more cases, including a wealthy Roman Jew who gave the order several paintings and valuable rare books in 1938. I'm afraid his name escapes me. Emanuele Giordano. Lavon eyed Gabriel over the ember of his cigarette.
How is it possible you know that name?
I met with Alessandro Ricci last night in Rome. He told me the Order of St. Helena is planning to steal the conclave and elect one of their members the next pope. Knowing the order, I'm sure it involves money.
It does.
Is that why they killed the pope?
No, said Gabriel.
They killed him because he wanted to give me a book.
What kind of book?
Do you remember when we found the ruins of Solomon's temple? Levon absently rubbed his chest. How could I forget?
Gabriel smiled.
This is better.
The office, like the Roman Catholic Church, was guided by ancient doctrine and dogma. Sacred and inviolable, it dictated that members of a large operational team travel to their destination by different routes. The exigencies of the situation, however, required all 8 members of the team to journey to Munich on the same El Al flight. Nevertheless, they staggered their arrival at the safe house, if only to avoid attracting unwanted attention from the neighbors. The first to arrive was Yossi Gavish, the Tweedy British-born head of research. He was followed by Mordechai and Oded, a pair of all-purpose field hands, and a kid named Ilan, who knew how to make the computers work. Next came Yaakov Rossmann and Dina Sarid. Yaakov was the head of special ops. Dina was a human database of Palestinian and Islamic terrorism who possessed an uncanny knack for spotting connections others missed. Both spoke fluent German. Mikhail Abramov wandered in around noon. Tall and lanky, with pale bloodless skin and eyes like glacial ice, he had immigrated to Israel from Russia as a teenager and joined the Sayeret Matkal, the IDF's elite special operations unit. Often described as Gabriel without a conscience, he had personally assassinated several top terror masterminds from Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. He now carried out similar assignments on behalf of the office, though his extraordinary talents were not limited to the gun.
A year earlier, he had led a team into Tehran and stolen Iran's entire nuclear archives.
He was accompanied by Natalie Mizrahi, who also happened to be his wife. Born and educated in France, fluent in the Algerian dialect of Arabic, she had traded a promising medical career for the dangerous life of an undercover office field agent. Her first assignment took her to Raqqa, the capital of the short-lived caliphate of the Islamic State, where she penetrated ISIS's external terrorism network. Were it not for Gabriel and Mikhail, the operation would have been her last. Like the other members of the team, Natalie had only the vaguest idea why she had been ordered to Munich. Now, in the half-light of the formal drawing room, she listened intently as Gabriel told the team the story of a well-deserved family vacation that was not to be. Summoned to Rome by Archbishop Luigi Donati, he had learned that Pope Paul VII, a man who had done so much to undo the Catholic Church's terrible legacy of anti-Semitism, had died under mysterious circumstances. Though skeptical that the Holy Father had been murdered, Gabriel had nonetheless agreed to use the resources of the office to undertake an informal investigation. It led him to Florence, where he witnessed the brutal killing of a missing Swiss guard, and then to a cottage outside Fribourg, where an unfinished letter fell from a framed picture of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. The letter concerned a book His Holiness had discovered in the Vatican secret archives, a book purportedly based on the memoirs of the Roman prefect of Judea who sentenced Jesus to death by crucifixion, a book that contradicted the accounts of Jesus' death contained in the canonical Gospels, accounts that were the seedbed of 2,000 years of sometimes murderous anti-Semitism. The book was missing, but the men who took it were hiding in plain sight. They were members of a reactionary and secretive Catholic order founded in southern Germany by a priest who found much to admire in the politics of the European far right, especially National Socialism. The spiritual descendants of this priest, whose name was Ulrich Schiller, planned to steal the approaching papal conclave and elect one of their own as the next supreme pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. As chief of the office, Gabriel had determined that such a development would not be in the interests of the State of Israel or Europe's 1.5 million Jews. Therefore, it was his intention to help his friend Luigi Donati steal the conclave back. To do so required undeniable proof of the order's plot. Time was of the essence. Gabriel needed the information no later than Thursday night, the eve of the conclave. Fortunately, he had identified 2 important lay members involved in the conspiracy. One was a reclusive German industrialist named Jonas Wolf. The other was a former BFV officer named Andreas Estermann. Estermann would be arriving at Café Adagio
on the Beethovenplatz at 6 p.m. Wednesday. He would be expecting a Swiss intelligence officer named Christoph Pittel. He would find the office instead. Immediately following his abduction, he would be brought to the Munich safe house for questioning. Gabriel decreed that the interrogation would not be a fishing expedition. Estermann would merely sign his name to a statement the team had already prepared, a bill of particulars detailing the order's plot to steal the conclave. A retired professional, he would not break easily. Leverage would be required. The team would have to find that too. All in a span of just 30 hours. They lodged not a word of protest and posed not a single question. Instead, they opened their laptops, established secure links to Tel Aviv, and went to work. 2 hours later, as a gentle snow whitened the lawns of the Englischer Garten, they fired their first shot. Chapter 37. Munich. The email that landed on Andreas Estermann's phone a few seconds later appeared to have been sent by Christoph Pittel. In truth, it had been dispatched by a 22-year-old MIT-educated hacker from Unit 8200 in Tel Aviv. It sat on Estermann's device for nearly 20 minutes, long enough for Gabriel to fear the worst. Finally, Estermann opened it and clicked on the attachment, a decade-old photograph of a Swiss-German gathering of spies in Bern. In doing so, he unleashed a sophisticated malware attack that instantly seized control of the phone's operating system. Within minutes, it was exporting a year's worth of emails, text messages, GPS data, telephone metadata, and internet browsing history, all without Estermann's knowledge. The unit bounced the material securely from Tel Aviv to the safe house, along with a live feed from the phone's microphone and camera. Even Estermann's calendar entries, past and future, were theirs to peruse at will. On Wednesday evening, he had a single appointment, drinks at Café Adagio, 6 o'clock. Estermann's contacts contained the private mobile numbers of Bishop Hans Richter and his private secretary, Father Marcus Graf. Both succumbed to malware attacks launched by Unit 8200, as did Cardinal Camerlengo Domenico Albanese and Cardinal Archbishop Franz von Emmerich of Vienna, the man whom the order had selected to be the next pope. Elsewhere in Estermann's contacts, the team found evidence of the order's astonishing reach. It was as if an electronic version of Father Schiller's leather-bound ledger had fallen into their laps. There were private phone numbers and email addresses for Austrian Chancellor Jörg Kaufmann, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Saviano, Cécile Leclerc of France's Popular Front, Peter van der Meer of the Dutch Freedom Party, and, of course, Axel Brunner of Germany's far-right National Democrats. Analysis of the phone's metadata revealed that Estermann and Brunner had spoken 5 times during the past week alone, a period that coincided with Brunner's sudden surge in German public opinion polls. Fortunately for the team, Estermann conducted much of his personal and professional correspondence via text message. For sensitive communications, he used a service that promised end-to-end encryption and complete privacy, a promise Unit 8200 had long ago rendered empty. Not only was the team able to see his current texts in real time, they were able to review his deleted messages as well. Gabriel's name featured prominently in several exchanges, as did Luigi Donati's. Indeed, Donati had appeared on the Order's early warning system within hours of the Holy Father's death. The Order had been aware of Gabriel's arrival in Rome and of his presence in Florence. It had learned of his visit to Switzerland from Father Erich, the village priest from Rechthalten. The phone betrayed that Estermann had visited Switzerland as well. GPS data confirmed he spent 49 minutes in Café du Gothard in Fribourg on the Saturday after the Holy Father's death. Afterward, he had driven to Bonn, where he switched off the phone for a period of 2 hours and 57 minutes. If there was a bright spot, it was the cleanliness of Estermann's personal life. The team found no evidence of a mistress or fondness for pornography. Estermann's consumption of news was broad, but tilted decidedly to the right. Several of the German websites he visited daily trafficked in false and misleading stories that inflamed public opinion against Muslim immigrants and the political left. Otherwise, he had no nasty browsing habits. But no man is perfect, and few are without at least one weakness.
Esterman's, it turned out, was money. Analysis of his encrypted text messages revealed that he was in regular contact with a certain Herr Hassler, owner of a private bank in the Principality of Liechtenstein. Analysis of Herr Hassler's records, conducted without his consent, revealed the existence of an account in Esterman's name. The team had found numerous such accounts spread throughout the world, but the one in tiny Liechtenstein was different. Esterman's wife, Johanna, is the beneficiary, said Dina Sarid. What's the current balance? Asked Gabriel. Just north of $1.5 million. When was it opened? About 3 months ago. He's made 16 deposits. Each one was 100,000 euros exactly. If you ask me, he's skimming from the payments he's making to the cardinals. What about the Vatican Bank? The accounts of 12 of the cardinal electors have received large wire transfers in the last 6 weeks. 4 were over $1 million. The rest were around 800,000. All of them can be traced back to Esterman. But the ultimate source of the money was the secretive Munich-based conglomerate that Alessandro Ricci had described as the Order of St. Helena Incorporated. Elie Lavon, the team's most experienced financial investigator, took it upon himself to penetrate the company's defenses. They were formidable, which came as no surprise. After all, he had matched wits with the order once before. 20 years ago, he had been at a distinct disadvantage. Now, he had Unit 8200 in his corner, and he had Jonas Wolf. The German businessman proved to be as elusive as the company that bore his name, beginning with the basics of his biography. As far as Lavon could tell, Wolf had been born somewhere in Germany, sometime during the war. He'd been educated at Heidelberg University, of that Lavon was certain, and had earned a PhD in applied mathematics. He acquired his first company, a small chemical firm, in 1970 with money borrowed from a friend. Within 10 years, he'd expanded into shipping, manufacturing, and construction. And by the mid-1980s, he was an extraordinarily wealthy man. He purchased a graceful old townhouse in the Maxvorstadt district of Munich and a valley high in the Obersalzberg, northeast of Berchtesgaden. It was his intention to create a baronial refuge for his family and their descendants. But when his wife and 2 sons were killed in a private plane crash in 1988, Wolf's mountain redoubt became his prison. Once or twice a week, weather permitting, he traveled to Wolf Group's headquarters in North Munich by helicopter. But for the most part, he remained in the Obersalzberg, surrounded by his small army of bodyguards. He had not granted an interview in more than 20 years. Not since the release of an unauthorized biography that accused him of arranging the plane crash that killed his family. Reporters who tried to pry open the locked rooms of his past faced financial ruin or, in the case of a meddlesome British investigative journalist, physical violence. Wolf's involvement in the reporter's death, she was killed by a hit-and-run driver while cycling through the countryside near Devon, was much rumored but never proven. To Elie Lavon, the story of Jonas Wolf's spectacular rise sounded too good to be true. There was, for a start, a loan Wolf had received to purchase his first company. Lavon had a hunch, based on hard-won experience, that Wolf's lender had been a Canton Zug-based concern known as the Order of St. Helena. Furthermore, Lavon was of the opinion, again it was merely well-informed conjecture, that the Wolf Group was far larger than advertised. Because it was an entirely private company, one that had never received a single loan from a single German bank, Lavon's options for traditional financial inquiry were limited. Esterman's phone, however, opened many doors within the firm's computer network that might otherwise have remained closed, even to the cyber sleuths at Unit 8200. Shortly after 8 o'clock that evening, they tunneled into Jonas Wolf's personal database and found the keys to the kingdom, a 200-page document detailing the company's global holdings and the staggering income they generated. $2.5 billion in pure profit last year alone, announced Lavon. And where do you think it all goes? That evening, the team set aside its work long enough to share a traditional family meal. Mikhail Abramov and Natalie Mizrahi were absent, however, for they dined at Café Adagio in the Beethovenplatz. It was located in the basement level of a yellow building on the square's northwestern flank. By day it served bistro fare, but at night it was one of the neighborhood's most popular bars. Mikhail and Natalie
pronounced the food mediocre, but judged the likelihood of successfully abducting a patron to be quite high.
3 stars on the Michelin scale, quipped Michael upon their return to the safe house. If Esteban comes to Café Adagio alone, he leaves in the back of a van.
The team took delivery of the vehicle in question, a Mercedes transit van, at 9 the following morning, along with 2 Audi A8 sedans, 2 BMW motor scooters, a set of false German registration plates, 4 Jericho 45 caliber pistols, an Uzi Pro compact submachine gun, and a 9mm Beretta with a walnut grip. At which point the tension in the safe house seemed to rise by several notches. As was often the case, Gabriel's mood darkened as the 0 hour drew near. Mikhail reminded him that a year earlier, in a warehouse in a drab commercial district of Tehran, a 16-member team had blowtorched its way into 32 safes and removed several hundred computer disks and millions of pages of documents. The team had then loaded the material into a cargo truck and driven it to the shore of the Caspian Sea, where a boat had been waiting. The operation had shocked the world and proved once again that the office could strike at will, even in the capital of its most implacable foe.
And how many Iranians did you have to kill in order to get out of the country alive? Details, details, said Mikhail dismissively. The point is we can do this with our eyes closed.
I'd rather you do it with your eyes open. It will substantially increase our chances of success. By midday, Gabriel had managed to convince himself that they were doomed to failure, that he would spend the rest of his life in a German prison cell for crimes too numerous to recall. An ignoble end to a career against which all others would be measured. Elie Lavon accurately diagnosed the source of Gabriel's despair, for he was suffering from the same malady. It was Munich, thought Lavon, and it was the book. It was never far from their thoughts, especially Lavon's. There was not one member of the team whose life had not been altered by the longest hatred. Nearly all had lost relatives to the fires of the Holocaust. Some had been born only because one member of a family had found the will to survive. Like Isabel Feldman, the only surviving child of Samuel Feldman, who handed over a small fortune in cash and valuables to the Order of St. Helena in exchange for false baptismal certificates and false promises of protection. Another such woman was Irene Frankel. Born in Berlin, she was deported to Auschwitz in the autumn of 1942. Her parents were gassed upon arrival, but Irene Frankel left Auschwitz on the death march in January 1945. She arrived in the new state of Israel in 1948. There she met a man from Munich, a writer, an intellectual who had escaped to Palestine before the war. In Germany, his name had been Greenberg, but in Israel, he had taken the name Alon. After marrying, they vowed to have 6 children, 1 for each 1,000,000 murdered, but a single child was all her womb could bear. She named the child Gabriel, the messenger of God, the interpreter of Daniel's visions. At 2 o'clock, they all realized it had been several minutes since anyone had seen him or heard his voice. A rapid search of the safe house revealed no trace of him, and a call to his phone received no answer. Unit 8200 confirmed the device was powered on and that it was moving through the Englischer Garten at a walking pace. Elie Lavon was confident he knew where it was headed. The child of Irene Frankel wanted to see where it had happened. Lavon couldn't blame him. He was suffering from the same malady. Chapter 38. Munich. In July 1935, 2.5 years after electorally seizing control of Germany, Adolf Hitler formally declared Munich the capital of the movement. The city's ties to National Socialism were undeniable. The Nazi Party was formed in Munich in the turbulent years after Germany's defeat in World War I. And it was in Munich in the autumn of 1923 that Hitler led the abortive beer hall putsch that resulted in his brief incarceration at Landsberg prison. There he penned the first volume of Mein Kampf, the rambling manifesto in which he described Jews as germs that needed to be exterminated. During his first year as chancellor, the year in which he transformed Germany into a totalitarian dictatorship, the book sold more than 1,000,000 copies.
Throughout the 15 cataclysmic years of the Nazi era, Hitler traveled to Munich frequently. He maintained a large, art-filled apartment at Prinz Regentenplatz 16 and commissioned the construction of a personal office building overlooking the Königsplatz.
Known as the Führerbau,
it contained living quarters for Hitler and his deputy, Rudolf Hess, and a cavernous central hall with twin stone staircases that led to a conference room. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain signed the Munich Agreement
in the Führerbau
on September 30, 1938. Upon his return to London, he predicted the accord would deliver peace in our time. A year later, the Wehrmacht invaded Poland, plunging the world into war and setting in motion the chain of events that would lead to the destruction of Europe's Jews. Much of central Munich was leveled by a pair of devastating Allied bombing raids in April 1944, but somehow the Führerbau survived. Immediately after the war, the Allies used it as a storage facility for looted art. It was now the home of a respected school of music and theater where pianists, cellists, violinists, and actors perfected their craft in rooms where murderers once walked. Bicycles lined the building's leaden facade, and at the foot of the main step stood two bored-looking Munich police officers. Neither paid any heed to the man of medium height and build who paused to review the schedule of upcoming public recitals. He continued past the Alte Pinakothek, Munich's world-class art museum, and then turned left onto the Heerstrasse. It was 10 minutes before he caught his first glimpse of the modern tower rising above the Olympic Park. The old Olympic village lay to the north, not far from the headquarters of BMW and a highly profitable German conglomerate known as the Wolf Group. He found the Kannerstrasse and followed it to the squat three-story apartment house at number 31. The building had long ago been converted into student housing, but in early September 1972, it had been inhabited by members of Israel's Olympic team. At 4:30 a.m. on September 5th, 8 Palestinian terrorists, dressed in tracksuits, scaled an undefended fence, carrying duffel bags filled with Kalashnikov rifles, Tokarev semi-automatic pistols, and Soviet-made hand grenades. They used a stolen key to unlock the door of apartment 1. Two Israelis, wrestling coach Moshe Weinberg and weightlifter Yosef Romano, were murdered during the first moments of the siege. 9 others were taken hostage. For the remainder of that day, as a global television audience watched in horror, German authorities negotiated with two heavily disguised terrorists, one known as Issa, the other Tony. While across the street, the games continued. Finally, at 10 p.m., the hostages were flown by helicopter to Fürstenfeldbruck Air Base, where German police had put in place an ill-conceived rescue operation. It ended with the death of all 9 Israelis. Within hours of the massacre, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir ordered a legendary office agent named Ari Shamron to send forth the boys. The operation was codenamed Wrath of God, a phrase chosen by Shamron to give his undertaking the patina of divine sanction. One of the boys was a gifted young painter from Bezalel Academy of Arts and Design named Gabriel Alon. Another was Eli Lavon, a promising biblical archaeologist. In the Hebrew-based lexicon of the team, Lavon was an Ayin, a tracker. Gabriel was an Aleph, an assassin. For 3 years, they stalked their prey across Western Europe and the Middle East, killing at night and in broad daylight, living in fear that at any moment they might be arrested by local authorities and charged as murderers. In all, 12 men died at their hands. Gabriel personally killed 6 of the terrorists with a .22-caliber Beretta pistol. Whenever possible, he shot the victims 11 times, one for each Jew murdered at Munich. When finally he returned to Israel, his temples were gray. Lavon was left with numerous stress disorders, including a notoriously fickle stomach that troubled him to this day. He crept up on Gabriel without a sound and joined him in front of the Kannerstrasse 31. "I wouldn't do that again if I were you, Eli. You're lucky I didn't shoot you. I tried to make a bit of noise. Try harder next time." Lavon looked up toward the balcony of apartment 1. "Come here often?" "Actually, it's been a while." "How long?" "100 years, said Gabriel distantly. "I come here every time I'm in Munich, and I always think the same thing." "What's that, Eli?"
Our Olympic team should never have been assigned to this building. It was too isolated. We expressed our concerns to the Germans a few weeks before the games began, but they assured us our athletes would be safe. Unfortunately, they neglected to tell us that German intelligence had already received a tip from a Palestinian informant that the Israeli team had been targeted. It must have slipped their minds. Why didn't they warn us? Why didn't they take steps to protect our athletes? You tell me. They didn't tell us, said Lavon, because they didn't want anything to spoil their post-war coming out party. Least of all, a threat against the descendants of the same people they had tried to exterminate just 30 years before. Remember, the German intelligence and security services were founded by men like Reinhard Gehlen, men who had worked for Hitler and the Nazis, men of the right who hated communism and Jews in equal measure. It's no wonder they were attracted to someone like Andreas Esterman. He turned to Gabriel. Did you happen to notice the last job he held before his retirement? Head of Department 2, the Counter-Extremism Division. So why is he spending so much time on the phone with the likes of Axel Brunner? And why does he have the private cell number of every far-right leader in Europe? Lavon paused. And why did he turn off his phone for 3 hours in Bonn the other night? Maybe he has a girlfriend there. Esterman? He's a choir boy. A doctrinaire choir boy. Lavon lifted his gaze once more toward the facade of the building. A light was burning in the window of apartment 1. Do you ever imagine how differently our lives would have turned out if it hadn't happened? Munich? No, answered Lavon. All of it. 2,000 years of hatred. We'd be as numerous as all the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore, just as God promised Abraham. I'd be living in a grand apartment in the first district of Vienna, a leader in my field, a man of distinction. I'd spend my afternoons sipping coffee and eating strudel at Café Stacher, and my evenings listening to Mozart and Haydn. Occasionally, I'd visit an art gallery and see works by a famous Berlin painter named Gabriel Frankl, the son of Irene Frankl, the grandson of Viktor Frankl, perhaps the greatest German painter of the 20th century. Who knows? Perhaps I might even be wealthy enough to purchase one or two of his works. I'm afraid life doesn't work that way, Ailey. I suppose not. But would it be too much to ask for them to stop hating us? Why is anti-Semitism on the rise again in Europe? Why is it not safe to be a Jew in this country? Why has the shame of the Holocaust worn off? Why won't it ever end? 9 words, said Gabriel. A silence fell between them. It was Lavon who broke it. Who do you suppose it is? The Gospel of Pilate? Lavon nodded. Up a chimney. How appropriate. Lavon's tone was uncharacteristically bitter. He started to light a cigarette but stopped himself. It goes without saying that the Nazis were the ones who annihilated the Jews of Europe. But they could not have carried out the final solution unless Christianity had first plowed the soil. Hitler's willing executioners had been conditioned by centuries of church teachings about the evils of the Jews. Austrian Catholics made up a disproportionate share of the death camp officers, and the survival rates for Jews were far lower in Catholic countries. But thousands of Catholics risked their lives to protect us. Indeed, they did. They chose to act on their own initiative rather than wait for encouragement from their pope. As a result, they saved their church from the moral abyss. Lavon's eyes searched the old Olympic village. We should be getting back to the safe house. It will be dark soon. It already is, said Gabriel. Lavon finally lit his cigarette. Why do you suppose he switched off his phone for 3 hours the other night? Esterman? Lavon nodded. I don't know, answered Gabriel. But I intend to ask him. Maybe you should ask him about the Gospel of Pilate, too. Don't worry, Ailey. I will. When Gabriel and Lavon returned to the safe house, the members of the snatch team were gathered in the sitting room, dressed for an evening out at a trendy café in the Beethovenplatz. There was no outward sign of nerves other than the incessant tapping of Mikhail's forefinger against the arm of his chair. He was listening intently to the voice of Andreas Esterman
who was addressing the members of his senior staff about the need to increase security at all Wolf Group facilities, especially the chemical plants. It seemed Esterman had received a warning from an old contact at the BFV, a warning the team had overheard. The system, apparently, was blinking red. By 5:15 it was blinking red inside the safe house as well. The members of the snatch team took their leave in the same manner they had arrived, intermittently, alone or in pairs, so as not to attract attention from the neighbors. By 5:45 they all had reached their fail-safe points. Their quarry left Wolf Group headquarters 17 minutes later. Gabriel watched his progress on an open laptop computer, a blinking blue light on a map of central Munich, courtesy of the compromised phone. It had already told Gabriel nearly everything he needed to know to prevent the Order of St. Helena from stealing the conclave. Still, there were one or two matters Andreas Esterman needed to clear up. If he had any sense, he would offer no resistance. Gabriel was in a dangerously bad mood. They were in Munich, after all, the capital of the movement, the city where murderers once walked. Chapter 39. Beethovenplatz, Munich. Just north of Munich's central train station, the traffic came to an abrupt halt. It was another police checkpoint. There were several around the city, mainly near transportation hubs and in squares and markets where large numbers of pedestrians congregated. The entire country was on edge, bracing itself for the next attack. Even the BFV, Andreas Esterman's old service, was convinced another bombing was inevitable. Esterman was of a similar mind. Indeed, he had reason to believe the next attack would occur as early as tomorrow morning, probably in Cologne. If successful, the physical destruction and death toll would tear at the very soul of the country, touch an ancient nerve. It would be Germany's 9/11. Nothing would ever be the same. Esterman checked the time on his iPhone, then swore softly. Immediately he pleaded with God for forgiveness. The strictures of the order forbade all forms of profanity, not just those involving the Lord's name. Esterman did not smoke cigarettes or drink alcohol, and regular fasting and exercise helped to keep down his weight, despite a weakness for traditional German cooking. His wife Johanna was a member of the order too. So were their six children. The size of their family was unusual in modern Germany, where birth rates had fallen below replacement level. Esterman again checked the time. 6:04. He dialed Christoph Bittel's number but received no answer. Then he dashed off a text message, explaining that he had left the office later than planned and was now stuck in traffic. Bittel replied instantly. It seemed he was running behind schedule as well, which was not like him. Bittel was usually as punctual as a Swiss timepiece. At last, the traffic inched forward. Esterman saw the reason for the delay. The police were searching a delivery van outside the entrance of the station. The passengers, two young men, Arabs or Turks, lay spread-eagled on the pavement. Esterman took no small amount of pleasure in their predicament. When he was a boy growing up in Munich, he rarely saw a foreigner, especially one with brown or black skin. That changed in the 1980s, when the floodgates opened. 12 million immigrants now resided in Germany, 15% of the population. The overwhelming majority were Muslims. Unless present trends were reversed, native Germans would soon be a minority in their own land. Esterman turned onto the Goethestrasse, a quiet street lined with elegant old apartment houses, and eased into an empty space along the curb at 6:10. He lost 3 additional minutes purchasing a chit from the automatic dispenser and another 2 walking the rest of the way to Café Adagio. It was a dimly lit room with a few tables arranged around a platform where, later that evening, a trio of American jazz musicians would perform. Esterman did not care for jazz, nor did he much like the clientele of Café Adagio. At a darkened table in the corner, 2 women, at least Esterman thought they were women, were kissing. A couple of tables away sat 2 men. One had a hard, pitted face, the other was thin as a reed. They looked like Eastern Europeans, maybe Jews. At least they weren't queers. Esterman hated queers even more than he hated Jews and Muslims. Bittel was nowhere to be seen. Esterman sat down at a table as far from the other patrons as possible. At length, a tattooed girl with purple hair wandered over. She looked at Esserman for a moment as though waiting for him to utter the secret password.
Diet Coke.
The waitress withdrew. Esserman checked his phone. Where the hell was Battelle? And why in God's name had he chosen a place like Café Adagio? Andreas Esterman's discomfort was so transparent that Gabriel waited 10 additional minutes before informing the German that, owing to a work emergency, Christoph Battelle would not be able to meet for a drink as planned. Esterman's face, viewed through the camera lens of his compromised phone, twisted into a grimace. He sent a curt response, tossed a 5-euro banknote onto the table, and stormed into the street. Fuming, he pounded along the pavements of the Goethestrasse to his car, where his rising anger boiled over. A man was sitting on the hood, his boots resting on the bumper, a girl between his legs. His pale skin was luminous in the lamplight. The girl was very dark, like an Arab. Her hands were resting on the man's thighs. Her mouth was on his. Esterman could have only limited memory of what happened next. There was an exchange of words, followed by an exchange of blows. Esterman threw a single wild punch, but was on the receiving end of several compact, carefully delivered elbows and knees. Incapacitated, he crumpled to the pavement. From somewhere a van materialized. Esterman was hurled into the back like war dead. He felt a sharp pain in his neck, and instantly his vision began to swim. The last thing he remembered before losing consciousness was the face of the woman. She was an Arab. He was sure of it. Esterman hated Arabs, almost as much as he hated Jews. Chapter 40. Munich. There is no such thing, practitioners of the secret trade like to say, as a perfect covert operation. The best a careful planner can do is limit the chances of failure and exposure, or, worse still, of arrest and prosecution. Sometimes the planner willingly accepts a modicum of risk when lives are at stake or his cause is just. And sometimes he must resign himself to the fact that a small measure of serendipity of providence will determine whether his ship reaches port safely or smashes itself to pieces on the rocks. Gabriel struck just such a bargain with the operational gods that evening in Munich. Yes, he had lured Andreas Esterman to Café Adagio for what he thought was a meeting with an old acquaintance. But it was Esterman, not Gabriel, and his team, who had selected the place of his abduction. Fortunately, Esterman chose well. There was no traffic camera to record his disappearance, and no witness other than a dachshund in the window of an adjacent apartment building. 90 minutes later, after a brief stop in the countryside west of Munich for a change of license plates, the van returned to the safe house near the Englischer Garten. Bound and blindfolded, Andreas Esterman was transferred to a makeshift holding cell in the basement. Typically, Gabriel would have left him there for a day or two to ponder his fate while deprived of sight, sound and sleep. Instead, at 10:30, he instructed Natalie to hasten Esterman's return to consciousness. She injected him with a mild stimulant, along with a little something to take the edge off, something to distort his sense of reality, something to loosen his tongue. Consequently, Esterman offered no resistance when Mordechai and Oded secured him to a metal chair outside the holding cell. On the opposite side of a table, flanked by Yaakov Rossmann and Eli Lavon, sat Gabriel. Behind him was a tripod-mounted Solaris phone. Blindfolded, Esterman knew none of this. He only knew that he was in a great deal of trouble. The matter before him, however, was easily resolved. All that was required was his signature on a statement, a bill of particulars, names and numbers. At 10:34 p.m., Esterman's inquisitor spoke for the first time. The camera captured the expression on the portion of the German's face not concealed by the blindfold. Later, the video would be analyzed by the specialists at Kingsall Boulevard. All were in agreement on one point. It was a look of profound relief. Though cursed with a flawless memory, Gabriel sometimes found it hard to accurately recall his mother's face. Two of her self-portraits hung in his bedroom in Jerusalem. Each night, before he drifted off to sleep, he saw her as she had seen herself, a tormented figure rendered in the manner of the German expressionists.
Like many young women who survived the Holocaust, she struggled with the demands of caring for a child. She was prone to melancholia and violent mood swings. She could not show pleasure on festive occasions and did not partake of rich food or drink. She wore a bandage always on her left arm, over the faded numbers tattooed into her skin. 29395. She referred to them as her mark of Jewish weakness, her emblem of Jewish shame. Painting, like motherhood, was an ordeal for her. Gabriel used to sit on the floor at her feet, scribbling in his sketchpad, while she labored at her easel. To distract herself, she used to tell stories of her childhood in Berlin. She spoke to Gabriel in German, in her thick Berlin accent. It was Gabriel's first language, and even now it was the language of his dreams. His Italian, while fluent, bore the faint but unmistakable trace of a foreigner's intonation. But not his German. No matter where he traveled in the country, no one ever assumed he was anything but a native speaker of the language, one who had been raised in the center of Berlin. Andreas Estermann clearly assumed that was the case as well, which prompted his misplaced expression of relief. It faded quickly once Gabriel explained why he had been taken into custody. Gabriel did not identify himself, though he implied he was a secret member of the Order of St. Helena, who had been asked by Herr Wolf and Bishop Richter to investigate certain financial irregularities that had recently come to their attention. These irregularities concerned the existence of a bank account in the Principality of Liechtenstein. Gabriel recited the current balance and the dates on which deposits had been made. Then he read aloud the text messages Estermann had exchanged with his private banker, Herr Hassler, lest Estermann entertain any thought of wriggling off the hook. Next, Gabriel turned his attention to the source of the money that Estermann had embezzled from the order. It was money, he said, that was supposed to have been delivered to the cardinal electors who had agreed to vote for the order's candidate at the coming conclave. At the mention of the prelate's name, Estermann gave a start and then spoke for the first time. With a single objection, he confirmed both the existence of the plot and the name of the cardinal whom the order had selected to be the next pope.
How do you know it's Emmerich?
What do you mean? Asked Gabriel.
Only a handful of us are aware of the conclave apparition.
I'm one of them.
But I would know who you are.
Why would you assume that?
I know the names of all the secret members of the order.
Obviously, said Gabriel, that's not the case. Receiving no further protest, Gabriel returned to the topic of the payments. It seemed several of the prelates had informed Cardinal Albanese that the agreed-upon sums of cash had not appeared in their accounts.
But that's not possible. Father Graf told me last week that all the cardinals had received their money.
Father Graf is working with me on this matter. He misled you at my request.
Bastard.
The order forbids such language, Herr Estermann, especially when it concerns a priest.
Please, don't tell Bishop Richter.
Don't worry, it will be our little secret. Gabriel paused. But only if you tell me what you did with the money you were supposed to deliver to the cardinal electors.
I wired it into their accounts, just as Herr Wolf and Bishop Richter instructed. I never stole a single euro.
Why would the cardinals lie?
Isn't it obvious? They're trying to extort us into paying more money.
What about the account in Liechtenstein?
It is an operational account.
Why is your wife the beneficiary? Estermann was silent for a moment.
Do Herr Wolf and Bishop Richter know about the account?
Not yet, said Gabriel. And if you do everything I tell you, they never will.
What do you want?
I want you to call Herr Hassler first thing in the morning and tell him to wire that money to me.
Yes, of course. What else?
Gabriel told him.
All 42 names will be here all night.
Is there somewhere else you have to be?
My wife is expecting me for dinner.
I'm afraid you missed dinner a long time ago.
Can you at least remove the blindfold and these restraints?
The names, Herr Estermann, now.
Is there any particular order you want them?
How about alphabetically?
It would help if I had my phone.
You're a professional. You don't need your phone.
Esterman tilted his head toward the ceiling and drew a breath. Cardinal Acevedo. Tegucigalpa?
There's only one Acevedo in the College of Cardinals.
How much did you pay him?
1 million.
Where's the money?
Bank of Panama.
Next? Esterman cocked his head.
Ballantyne of Philadelphia.
How much?
1 million.
Where's the money?
The Vatican Bank.
Next. The last name on Esterman's list was Colonel Peter Zichov, the Archbishop of Esztergom, Budapest. 1 million euros payable to his personal account at Banco Popolare, Hungary. All totaled, 42 of the 116 cardinal electors who would choose the successor to Pope Paul VII had received money in exchange for their votes. The total cost of the operation was slightly less than $50 million. Every penny of it had come from the coffers of the Wolf Group, the global conglomerate otherwise known as the Order of St. Helena, Incorporated. "And that's all of the names?" probed Gabriel. "You're sure you haven't left anyone out?" Esterman shook his head vigorously. "The other 18 cardinals who will vote for Emmerich are members of the Order. They receive no payment beyond their monthly stipends." He paused. "And then there's Archbishop Donati, of course. 2 million euros. I deposited the money after he and the Israeli broke into the secret archives." Gabriel glanced at Elie Lavon. "And you're sure you didn't deposit that money in an account I don't know about?"
"No," said Esterman. "It's in Donati's personal account at the Vatican Bank."
Gabriel turned to a fresh page in his notebook, despite the fact he hadn't bothered to write down a single name or number. "Let's go through it one more time, shall we? Just to make certain we haven't missed anyone."
"Please," begged Esterman. "I have a terrible headache from the drugs you gave me."
Gabriel looked at Mordechai and Oded and, in German, instructed them to return Esterman to the holding cell. Upstairs, in the drawing room, he and Lavon reviewed the recording on a laptop computer. "That clerical suit you wore into the secret archives the other day must have rubbed off on you. For a moment, even I was convinced you were a member of the Order." Gabriel advanced the recording and clicked play.
"2 million euros. I deposited the money after he and the Israeli broke into the secret archives."
Gabriel clicked pause. "Rather clever on their part, don't you think? They obviously don't intend to go down without a fight."
"Neither do I. What do you have in mind?"
"I'm going to have a word with him." Gabriel paused. "Face to face."
"You've got everything you need," said Lavon. "Let's get out of here before some nice German police officer knocks on the door and asks if we know anything about a missing senior executive from the Wolf Group."
"We can't release him until white smoke rises from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel.
So we'll tape him to a tree somewhere in the Alps on our way down to Rome. With any luck, no one will find him until the glaciers melt."
Gabriel shook his head. "I want to know why he has the private phone number of every major far-right leader in Western Europe. And I want that book."
"It went up a chimney, you said so yourself."
"Just like my grandparents." Gabriel turned without another word and headed downstairs to the cellar. There he instructed Mordechai and Oded to remove Esterman from the holding cell. Once again, the German offered no resistance as he was secured to the chair. At 12:42 a.m., the blindfold was removed. The camera of the Solaris phone captured the expression on Esterman's face. Later, at Kingsall Boulevard, all were in agreement on one point. It was one of Gabriel's finest hours.